Dan Hieronymus joins me this week to discuss hop breeding programs and new hop varieties. This is Beersmith Podcast number 221.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 221, and it's early September 2020. Stan Hieronymus joins me this week to discuss hop breeding programs and new hop varieties. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller with exact precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and amazing advanced settings. Whatever your setup, the Brew Commander offers precision temperature control and perfect repeatability. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. For more information, again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith Brewing Software a try. I recently released the Beersmith 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops and has authored a number of books as well, including Brewing Local, Brew Like a Monk, and Brewing with Wheat. Stan has also penned hundreds of periodicals and is a certified beer judge. Stan, it's always a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thanks. It's always my pleasure to be here.
So how are you doing? I guess you've been doing a lot of club presentations and probably not traveling as much as you used to, right?
Not much travel at all. You know, a few weekends, you know, you can get in your car and rent a cabin, make sure it's clean and get away from stuff. But, that's most of what we've been able to do.
But no more globe trotting to various beer events, I guess, huh?
No trips out of the country. I did go to Montreal in January, to speak to a brewer's group. Otherwise, I was starting to look and trying to figure out the last year that I didn't leave the United States, and I know it's more than 15 years ago. Wow. So I certainly miss seeing what's going on in the rest of the world.
But on the positive side, we've both been doing quite a few clubs, right? Beer clubs,
right? And it's places you. And talking to brewers, although you would talk to a lot of these people because you see them at Homebrew Con, for instance.
True.
Instead at Homebrew Con doing that, people saw me, but I didn't see them. So you still do have the interaction with homebrewers, which is something I really enjoy.
Absolutely. And then you mentioned also on the positive side, you've been doing a lot of learning, right?
Yeah, that it's nice that both Hopsteiner and Barthaz this summer had multiple sessions, from things from hop breeding to the latest discoveries about chemistry, advanced hop products. It's a great way to catch up. Again, seeing people say these things versus reading them in a technical paper makes it much easier to envision what's going on.
And so I think you've been doing a lot of their online, they have online programs, I guess, Hopsteiner or something?
Yeah, but Hopsteiner did, I think they've got a new series coming up as well. And then Barthas did their Hops Academy.
Very cool. Well, today you wanted to dive into hop breeding programs and also some of the new hop varieties that are to come out on the market. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the hop breeding program? When did it really start?
In earnest, hop breeding starts at the end of the 19th century because farmers, whether it was a disease or pest or a drought, every third or fourth year, they would get almost nothing from the harvest. So they would overproduce the others in order to make up for that. And they also recognized that they could get, quote, better hops. The plant is dioecious, meaning that there are male and female plants. We're using the cones from the female plants. Mm-hmm. The people processing the hops and brewers do not particularly want seeds in those cones. Previously, they would be there. So now the male plants are well separated from the female plants, but they are used in the breeding process. You get the pollen from the male with the female. The female produces seeds. Each one is unique. They're like people. They don't grow true to seed. So every time you pollinate a Cascade plant, that new plant is going to be something different than Cascade. That's going to be just a little bit different. So hops were just selected over time, and they would be a little bit of chosen whether they were disease resistant, but mostly they were chosen on their brewing quality.
For example, you can't go out and buy hop seeds. That's why we go and get rhizomes, right?
That's correct. So you're basically cloning them. You can also clone them from the leaves and start new plants that way as well. And that when you're taking a new variety and trying to get a whole bunch of new plants, that's some propagators use that process. Some split the rhizomes. Those are both ways that you can prop them up. But at the beginning of the 20th century, at Wye College in England, which is in the Kent hop growing region, Ernest Salmon was the first one to say, I think I can take these varieties that brewers want. And this is in the UK, but he was also interested in some from the continent. So it would include these, what we refer to as land race varieties. That means they were just chosen based upon how they grew. So you had Golding and Fuggle in the UK, Saz and Hallertau, Middlefru.
Interesting. So Saz was actually bred then?
No, Saz wasn't bred. These are land race hops. These are the land race hops. And he could cross those with hops from North America, which had different quality. To get hops that were more disease resistant, they also were higher yielding, so they had more alpha. Mm-hmm. And he began doing that cross-pollination at the beginning of the 20th century. There was one particular plant that he brought from Manitoba in Canada and crossed it, put it in a field at Wye College, and it was open-pollinated, meaning that you knew who the mother was, but the father was just going to be pollen from plants nearby. It was likely a Fuggle or a Golding. And some of the seedlings off of that, one seedling produced Brewer's Gold, a hop that is still grown today. Another produced Bullion, which is a hop that is grown in a very limited scale some places. But Brewer's Gold has been, over time, super important for breeding of other hop varieties. Centennial is, for instance, is two-thirds Brewer's Gold. Hercules, which is grown in Germany for its alpha production, which is then turned to CO2 extract, and large breweries around the world use relatively small amounts of that in their pale lagers. But overall, it becomes the number one alpha hop in the world. And then there's also Brewer's Gold and Citra, which is the number one aroma hop in the world. So you can see this heritage goes back a ways.
And as we get into the mid 20th century, things start, you know, we start to get more sophisticated with a breeding program, right? They're looking for very particular characteristics they're trying to breed in, right?
Yeah. And it's a challenge. It's only in the last few years that the hop genome has been mapped, and that's not complete yet. But Hopsteiner, for instance, which is Hopsteiner and Barth Haas, the world's two vendors, Hopsteiner's breeding program is looking at genetic markers, and that allows for more efficient breeding.
And there was a push, I believe, to create a lot of these high alpha hops because they were interested in the yield, right? And they're interested in turning a lot of it into CO2 extract for the big brewers, right?
Right, exactly. So, and when beer was not being produced with flavor as important as it is now, trying to say that in a way that's not too insulting to pale lagers, then people just wanted alpha as a commodity. So the more alpha you could get out of an acre, the more efficiently, then it was cheaper to buy. And that was a certain amount of focus in the breeding programs that began to change in the last 20 or 30 years.
Well, so that was my next question. How did the craft beer revolution really start to change and drive hop breeding programs?
Well, it's changed, not just, it's changed what's grown, and therefore it's changed breeding. So first of all, a lot more Cascade and Centennial. Because of the rise of Citra and Mosaic, Cascade and Centennial acreage is down some now, but it reached more than 10,000 acres. And you could look at the early in the 21st century, there wasn't 500 acres of Centennial. Cascade would bounce around, but it would be only a few thousand acres. So as brewers wanted these hops with New World aroma, then the breeding programs began to look for those qualities. They were getting higher alpha anyway. If you look at the alpha of, say, Mosaic, that's more than a lot more than Target, which came out of the UK, a public breeding program, and that was the alpha hop in the 90s.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit about public versus private programs? You mentioned we were discussing before the show a little bit, but that there is a big difference, right?
Well, so John Iahas in Washington State had the first private program in the United States in the 1970s. These were growers who wanted some qualities. In their hops, a lot of times it was alpha, that they were not getting from the public program, which was not as robust.
What's a public program? Can you talk?
So the first, the Y College program, for instance, we talked about in the UK, that was funded by the British government.
Okay.
In Germany, the hop research facility there, funded by the government. In the United States, the U.S. Department of Agriculture began a public program in Corvallis, Oregon, Oregon State University, in the 1930s. And what they were looking at primarily is concerns about disease, like we talked about before, and pests. And so you would get more plants that were more robust. In some cases, it was just a matter of choosing a better clone.
Mm-hmm.
And say, oh, if you grow with this, you're going to be better off. And over time, they began to do more breeding. Cascade, for instance, comes from a large bank of hops and breeding in the 50s. In 55, there's a cross made. In 56, a Cascade goes in the field, although it isn't released to farmers until 1972, because it takes a long time to bring the hop to market. But there weren't as many hops, and they were not exactly what originally a few farmers or programs might have been interested in. then a partnership between Yakima Chief Ranches and John I. Haas created the Hop Breeding Company in the early aughts. And the Hop Breeding Company has released many of the most popular varieties, Citra, Mosaic, most recently Sabro. And in that case, in order to recoup literally millions of dollars that they've invested in getting a new variety, a farmer is going to pay a license fee.
So that's the other interesting thing here is in addition to the public-private programs, a lot of hops now have sort of a web of licensing agreements tied to them, right?
Yeah, a web sounds more complicated than it might be, and there are different owners of these hops have different licensing setups, so we don't necessarily need to go into that. But that's one reason that a hop like Citra is going to be more expensive. If you want to use it, you have to help pay for the develop program. In Cascade, you did with your tax money help pay for the development program, but that you don't get to say specifically. So some of the money is going to go, as a taxpayer to maybe the interstate highways, and you don't get to say, I don't want that money to go to the highways. I just want it to go to hop development. If you were to do that, then the hops would be cheaper.
Interesting. So that's another reason why you can't, I believe you can't grow Mosaic in your backyard, right?
That's correct. But you can get Cascade and Centennial because they came from a public program, and Chinook and a lot of great hop varieties that way.
So the ones that are in public domain, you can grow in your backyard. The other ones that are licensed, probably not, right?
Yeah, you cannot. The plant right is licensed. The plant itself actually goes back, and some of those licensing agreements that the plant still belongs to the company that is leasing you the right to grow it.
So we've had these hop breeding programs at least since the 1930s. Why does it take so long to get a hop variety from, a test out to an actual breeding program? I'm production, I should say.
Well, say you're breeding yeast, you're getting literally those things are there. You're getting new varieties like in a lab where they got these machines doing it like every few days.
Correct.
In the case of hops, you only get. It takes every year for a plant to become different. So it's a once a year process. So that's what slows it down. So you think in a breeding program, you're going to pollinate a female plant, usually with a known male, in the fall, collect those seeds, and those seeds are going to go into a greenhouse the following spring. So you're already 6 months in the process, which generally is called year two. And that first year, all you're going to do is bombard those plants with disease, kill 90 to 95% of them. So it's an elimination process. Then in year three, you can begin to grow them as plants and look at their, again, you're still looking if they're disease resistant. Then you can begin to look at things like if they are resistant to pest.
And then doesn't it also take several years to actually produce production cones, right?
At that point, you're going to start to get cones. But at a production process, generally, you're going to get full capacity, except in the Yakima Valley, where it can be a faster process. So you can put a baby plant in the field in the spring and get a partial yield, maybe up to 70% that first year. But I also, I've talked to farmers in Germany with Herzbrucker, which is an old land race variety. The first year they put Herzbrucker in, they got a 70% yield as well. That was, those were off mature rhizomes. They also were irrigated, which most farms in Germany are not. But yeah, your production is not as good the first few years. But in years, say, three to five, there are only going to be, you know, the plants that selected, maybe three of them in the field, and you're starting to see how they act in the field. You see the agronomy, you begin to see if their yield is good enough. You can begin to get a sense of the size of the cones. So you see, you know, how much, you know, what we want in the hop is a lupulin. So, you know, how what's referred to as cone heavy the plants are. So how many cones and then the lupulin within the cone. So you begin to get a feel for what it's like and still has to pass all of these tests before you even start to ask, what does it smell like? What kind of aroma and flavor is it going to create in the beer? So then you'll be up to years, say, 6 and 8 that you start to do that. You can rub them in the field and say, ooh, this is good. Not so sure about this. And maybe towards the end of that process, have enough to give to brewers to do some small-scale brewing trials. All through this process, you're continuing to weed out hops. So maybe you started with 4,000 seeds, took that down, therefore, to 400 plants. Mm-hmm. And those plants, by the end of year 7 or so, you're going to be down to maybe 20 plants. That would be your goal. Once that you go, still passing the smell test, and it continued to do all the disease tests. And then you can begin to see, grow them to full size, and see what they're like in the field. During this process, the more feedback you can get, the better. That's always been a challenge for the breeder who before was talking primarily to brewers. And of course, brewers are waiting for samples so they can get the feedback from consumers. Now, in the U.S. public breeding program, for instance, which has recently been streamlined, now they're getting brewer feedback earlier. So it will make it easier down the road to bring more varieties, more public varieties to market.
In addition, of course, you've got the problem of starting to scale up production too, right? I mean, I assume at the beginning you're just working with a handful of plants, right?
Right. You're working in, and so, you know, in at a time that a breeder, which is actually the company, is going to say, okay, we think this plant is ready. It'll go maybe to 5 acres. And generally you get about 2,000 pounds, give or take, per acre. And, mm-hmm. and that's enough for some people to use and get the feedback from. At that 5 acre, they do not always pass the test. maybe there's suddenly an issue with some disease that they didn't realize was going to pop up. Because in the case of, and a lot of this is mildew, powdery and downy mildew, those diseases morph a little bit. So something that is, you know, something that gives a plant immunity all of a sudden doesn't give a plant immunity. Those things occur. So even at that 5, and by now you've invested in these 5 acres, which you might be able to sell, and certainly the process is changing where you can. But a farmer isn't going to want to put that in the field until you know. Your goal is, once you put that plant in the field, is to use it the next 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, there's an investment there that goes into it. So that's why it ends up, by the time you get a plant from the beginning of the process, that plant usually has more than $1 million invested in it.
Mm-hmm. And then how long does this whole process take? I've heard numbers like 15 years, 20 years. I mean, how long does it take to start with a new seedling?
The goal is more like to have a plan out in 9 to 13 years.
Still a long time.
Again, we can look at Citra. So Citra actually begins with, or the cross-pollination that created the Citra plant itself took place in 1990, and Citra was released to the public in 2008. That's not an unusual time frame. A new hop from Hopsteiner this year, and I don't have the number written down. It's called Contessa, mm-hmm. And its experimental number was X, 04 and then like three digits, 928 or something. That's not the right thing. But that X04 tells you that's a plant that went into the field in 2004. And brewers have been using that experimental hop at least, I think maybe 2014, definitely 2016. And this year it finally got a name. They said, okay, it'll be available on a wider scale. So it, 12 to 15 years is not unusual.
And my point is, even after the hop's released, it's not like you instantly have, 20,000 acres, right?
Correct. Because then you got to scale it up.
Right. And they're not grown from seeds. So you have to do it during this cloning process, right?
Are cloning. Yeah. So there was some excitement in 2014 when Cashmere was kind of rushed to market in the public program. And there were like 40 plants. Literally, almost nothing. So they had to be cloned up. So now it's only in the last couple of years, and it's a lovely hop. But some farmers rushed to put it in, and it did not grow well for them. So they backed off and said we're not interested. So it's taken, finding the right places for it to grow. I know CLS Farms, which is in Moxie in the middle of the Yakima Valley. Eric Desmarais is really happy with the way his Cashmere is growing.
Well, what are the major hop breeding programs and how many are there, roughly?
Well, so there's the U.S. public program. Mm-hmm. And then HBC has a large program in the U.S. Hopsteiner has a large program in the U.S. Recently in Michigan, Great Lakes Hops started making crosses about 2010. They released two varieties in 2015, Mackinac and Copper. And now this year they've got four new named hops out. And then there are smaller Jackson Farms in Idaho, for instance, a few years ago, did their own little breeding, came up with a hop that they originally called 007. Some people were calling it the James Bond hop, but its name is now Idaho 7, and that's certainly getting some traction. And that's a hop home brewers can find, for instance, Yakima Chief sells it. And then El Dorado, mm-hmm. which is CLS Farms, that came from a private breeding program. So there are smaller programs that are going on. And Indy Hops in Oregon, which is the company Indy Hops, which is a broker in Oregon. So they'll work with Oregon farmers. And then they put in the first pelleting plant in Oregon. And they've also funded a breeding program that works with Oregon State University. And their first released hop. So they started their program about 10 years ago. And Strata was commercialized in 2018. And that's becoming more widely available now. And this year they're to scale with a hop they call X033. And I would not be surprised if everything goes well this year, within a year or two, that hop should get a name and be more widely available. But then public programs around the world, Germany and the Czech Republic have had robust programs for a long time. Slovenia also has a relatively robust program. Hopsteiner is now, because they have all this breeding knowledge, they are also breeding hops specifically for the German market. And then the French subsidized hop breeding, so hops specifically for France, that was taking place at Y Hops, which is no longer at Y College. The British government ended funding of that. So it gets complicated because the British hop growers are funding some public hops. But Peter Darby, I have to look what time of the month, I think Peter may have now retired from Y Hops. So he continues to work with the French and help them with their breeding program. So meanwhile, the largest hop vendor in the UK has got involved with its own breeding program. That's Charles Ferrum Hops. And those are varieties that, again, American homebrewers can get from Barum. You know, then Jester was the first prominent one out of that for somebody looking for New World characteristic. More recently, I think Harlequin and Mystic are hops that are, for the most part, they got some of the bold, fruity American character, but on a little more restrained basis.
So what are the hot hops right now? What are the top hop varieties that everybody's trying to get?
Well, people are still trying to get Citra and Mosaic, obviously.
Yeah.
Acreage of those expanded a lot this year. Now, you know, there's some question about demand with what's going on with brewers. And
yeah, obviously the craft breweries have been decimated, to be honest, right?
Well, the New Belgium's going to make more beer this year than last year. Some at Sierra Nevada, I'm not, they'll probably come pretty close. So, and these are the people who use a lot of hops. And then, you know, as brewers going from using 4 pounds per barrel and dry hopping to 8 pounds per barrel of dry hopping, if they make the same amount of beer, they're using twice the amount of hops. So there's hop usage is not going to plummet totally. Like I said, Citra and Mosaic in the U.S. are the ones that there's been a lot of growth in. El Dorado acreage almost doubled this last year. Strata, which is still coming into the market, there
and that's it. What's
up quite a bit. Oh, I lost you.
Oh, I was saying what makes El Dorado so attractive? I wonder.
Oh, the aroma and the flavor. It's got that nice juiciness.
Yeah.
An important thing with these is people explore a little bit more. They get excited and they use it as a single hop. So when Sabro came out, mm-hmm. and Sabro's it's growing like crazy, and it's got that coconut element to it. And people were making pina colada beers, trying to emphasize the Sabro. It's really interesting, and you see it in single hop beers. But like the new hop, which came out this year, 2020, just got a name in the last couple of weeks. And it has been available to homebrewers as HBC 692 and commercial brewers as well. You know, it's called Talus. And that's going to be one people are really excited about. It's a daughter of Sabro, and it's a little more of a strain. So you could begin to use it with other hops. You put Sabro with other hops, it tends to dominate, you know. So people. And I think as more brewers recognize that they want these complementary flavors, then things like Strata and El Dorado become more attractive.
Which of these varieties can homebrewers actually get to grow at home? I know a lot of them are licensed.
Of the new ones, the newest one you could get would be Triumph, which came out of the public breeding program. Yeah, I think it got named at the end of 2018.
And what is Triumph? What are its characteristics?
It's definitely more restrained. It's got some fruitiness. As a homebrewer wise, it's not one at this point that I'd probably be trying to mess with growing. You're going to have a lot easier time getting things like Chinook and Cascade and Centennial. Your concern, quite honestly, depends. Spend a little bit more for these plants and make sure you're getting one that's been through the clean plant program and you know that's what you're actually getting. A lot of fields, Cascade's been around so long, as fields have got other hops in them, that you could be buying a Cascade plant and actually be getting cluster. Cluster's not a horrible hop. But if you're thinking, I want to have Cascade, you really want to have Cascade. And I think Chinook's a great hop to grow. You take it out of the Yakima Valley, it's less piney and it's more fruity, particularly pineapple. A lot of interesting Chinook out of the Midwest. And they're not saying a Great Lakes hops exactly what they're using, but I think because Chinook has done so well in Michigan, that Chinook may be part of the parenting in those new varieties from Great Lakes. We wouldn't be able to grow them, but they'd be interesting to brew with. And one thing Great Lakes is doing is making sure every homebrew shop in Michigan is getting some of these varieties.
Can you talk for a minute about the resurgence of hop growing outside of the Pacific Northwest? We're starting to see hops grown again, I think, in, as you mentioned, the Great Lakes region, for example.
A lot of hops in Michigan. New York was a little bit ahead in jumping back into it. They don't have as large of farms. And then you'll get, it takes one, Nebraska, you know, it takes one large farm saying, oh, I want to grow hops. Because you need these other components, it's not just a matter of growing the plants. You need to be able to pick them. And what this means is you need a hop picker, and which if you see one, it's not this thing with hands that pulls the cones off. It's got to go through this machinery. Get rid of all the leaves, the vines, everything else, and reduce it down to the cones. And you also want to get rid of the leaves, like I said, the leaves. You're blowing hops and shaking hops through the process to get it down to where you only have the cone. Mm-hmm. And then you have to dry it, and that requires kilns. And then you probably want to be able to turn it into pellets. So having enough hops to do all these things is what you need. So a lot of times they're going to a central location.
So the infrastructure, in addition to the actual fields, is very important, right?
So if you want to put in 600 acres of hops, which is it seems like a crazy large amount, but those are the increments they're added to, say in the Northwest in some cases. That's an investment of about $25 million. Mm-hmm.
I imagine the infrastructure associated with that is millions of dollars too, right?
Well, that's what I meant. That's getting the right size kiln. That's getting the picking machinery. That's getting all the tractors and things like that. That's putting in the trellis system and then planting your first set of plants. And that's more efficient than what people are doing in the Midwest because they cannot kiln at the same scale. Because you're putting in this hop kiln, getting this picking machine that you're going to use 4 to 5 weeks out of the year. Mm-hmm. And that's its only purpose. You can't use it for other stuff. Right. So it's the investment at the outset is pretty high. As more farmers in Indiana have got involved, then you can have a few central locations. You could harvest your hops and cut them, put them in a truck, and you take them to someplace that has a picking machine, and they can begin the process there. So therefore, the picking machine and the kilns are used efficiently.
So, I mean, is someplace like New York competitive? I know I actually have a great-great-great-grandfather that grew hops in New York back in the 1800s.
You're going to pay more for New York Cascade than you're going to pay for Washington Cascade. There are reasons to do it. Because first, as a brewer, you want to support local, and you hope your customers want to support local. In the case of New York, of course, they also have the farm brewery license. So if you're using New York malt and New York hops, you get some advantages in the marketplace.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of farm breweries pop up here in Virginia. I assume there's some law that allows them to.
Virginia is doing something. You're right as well. They've really promoted the farm brewers as well.
I assume the license is much cheaper or something like that, probably.
Well, in case it allows them to sell hop or sell their beer more places. So now you could sell like at farmers markets.
Interesting. Well, what characteristics are the new hop breeding programs focused on now?
Well, exotic aroma and flavor. It's really only been about 10 years ago, I think in Australia, maybe 2008, they introduced this idea of what they call flavor hops. This is confusing for an American home brewer. Mm-hmm. Because you used to think I was making this flavor addition, like, and that would generally be an aroma hop, but that addition, you'd start out, you make an addition at 60 minutes, and then you make this addition at 10 minutes, and that's when you were getting flavor from, and then you'd make the addition at zero or dry hopping where you get the aroma. Well, in reality, that addition at 10 minutes is not a flavor addition. That's a flavor reduction. 10 minutes of boiling eliminates half of the essential oil.
Right. So I've had people ask me about this continuous hopping and so on. Not a great idea, really, unless you're just trying to get bitterness, right?
Right. The longer it's in there, the more bitterness you get and the less essential oil. You boil away essential oil.
Most of us have moved to a single bittering addition, really, right?
Right. I personally like first word hopping, although there's no proof that it adds any aroma and flavor. I still like the character it gives to the beer. You should remember that with first word hopping, you are getting a little bit more isomerization, not an immense amount more, particularly if you're using lower alpha hops.
Right.
But the other thing that's happened is, I mentioned before that breeding that took place in 1917 that took hops of American heritage and put them together with hops of European heritage. So hops have been around 6 million years.
Wow.
But it's only a million or a million and a half years, and they started about Mongolia. A million to a million and a half years ago, they migrated rather quickly into what we now call Western Europe. And those are the land race varieties that defined, quote, fine aroma for the last 600 years.
You know, they migrated from where? This is interesting.
From China.
Okay.
From Mongolia. That way. They also went to the United States, across the Bering Strait, also into Japan. And those varieties, which we generally refer to as Neo-Mexicanus, are a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
They're more likely to contain geranium, and they're also more likely to contain the thiols. And the thiols, of course, are now leading to more tropical and exotic aromas and flavors.
I think we discussed that in the last episode when I had you on. You talked quite a bit about thiols, I believe.
Right. So you've got an interaction of thiols with some oxygenated compounds in what comes out of them. Because geranial, during the process of interaction with yeast, is now creating other odor compounds. You put those together, and that's when you can get pear or coconut.
Or the tropical fruits we talk about so much.
Tropical fruits and stuff like that. Those all come from hops that have some American in their background, because people are excited about the hops. And I didn't mention breeding programs, breeding program in New Zealand, breeding program in Australia, breeding program in South America. So,
And I think most of the Australia New Zealand hops have American heritage too, right?
Correct. That's what I was going to say. They have a background that goes into that. So they have those compounds. So you've got a new hop out of New Zealand to be available after their next harvest, which is in the spring, called Nectaron. That's a combination of saying nectar of the gods, and the breeder's name was Ron Beeston. So they put that together and called it Nectaron. And they're excited. You see people comparing it, saying this is the most exciting hop out of New Zealand since Nelson Sauvin. And this would also be an example. Nelson Sauvin, is farmers like that people will buy it, but it's a pain in the butt. It does not pick easily. It shatters when you're trying to pick it. So it's a difficult hop to work with. And additionally, you can't say we have a popular hop and that's the only thing we're going to grow, because most of these things have a best time to pick them that's, say, in a week, at the most a week to 10 days. And you want to use your whole 5 or 6 weeks where the hops come to harvest so you can use your equipment efficiently. So you're looking for varieties that might pick a little earlier or a little later. So that, you know, you get a wider time frame, and that's something else they get with Nectaron. In Australia, the hop right now is known as HPA, which is Hop Products Australia 016. It will be named in the next few months. So before they actually start growing it, because they'll be planting hops soon. That'll after this next harvest, that will be available as well. And that's an example of finding something that people are as excited about as Galaxy, but can be picked at a different time than Galaxy. So those are, you know, if I would say, you know, the three hops that just got named or are about to get named that people are going to be most excited about are going to be Talus, because from the hop breeding company means there'll be a fair amount of it available, and it is a really nice hop. Then the two hops from Down Under, and a lot of people are just getting to know Lotus from Hopsteiner, which was released last year. Mm-hmm. And that's got some vanilla and orange in it and unique characteristics. Hopsteiner released two more hops this year, Contessa, which I mentioned before, which is meant to be used in lagers and kolsches and things like that. And then a new hop that has lots of alpha, really resiny and oily. So figuring out how to use it correctly will be a factor. If you use an awful lot of it, you're going to get this super resiny, dank beer, I think. I'm trying to think what other, the ADHA, which used to be the American Dwarf Hop Association, now it's the Association of Development of Hop Agronomy. They have a new hop called Adena. That's another hop that's meant to be used in lagers and kolsches, and beers like that. So you've had from these breeding companies, American breeding companies, realizing some people want to brew lagers and that you have to be careful the hops you get from the continent, particularly as home brewers, that they're fresh. So you've got the hop breeding company in 2016 released Laurel, which is meant to say that's a combination of lemon and floral. And then you've got Contessa and Adena. Those are all new hop varieties out there meant to be an alternative to, say, some of the German and Czech ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stan, we're actually running out of time, but can you tell us where folks can learn a little bit more about some of the cutting end hop research, some of these new varieties that you talked about?
So, well, once a month, and it varies what time of month, and it's actually only 10 or 11 times a year, I have a newsletter. It's free. So if you go to appellationbeer.com, which is appellationbeer.com, when your name is Hieronymus, you should get a website that's name is easier to spell, but I didn't. And right on the front page there, you can see Hops newsletter. You sign up for that. I won't spam you. You'll just get that from time to time. And that's probably, unless you want to invest a lot of money on technical journals, which I've already done, that's the best way to learn.
Awesome, Stan. Well, Stan, thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Well, thanks for having me, and I look forward to the next time, and maybe we'll talk more about hops. We can talk about something else. Wheat beers. We should talk about wheat beers.
Always good, yeah. Always great to have Stan on the show. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops, as well as a number of other books, Brewing Local, Brewing with Wheat, Brew Like a Monk. And it's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks again, Stan.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Stan Hieronymus for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 brewing software a try. I've recently released the Beersmith 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial today, go to beersmith.com. Again, that's beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.